Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the November 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about my all-time favorite drummer, Keith Moon of The Who. And then a filter reissue of Patti Smith's 50th anniversary of her classic album, Horses. And then a classic album review of Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. And I begin with the article about The Who's drummer, Keith Moon, titled Shadow of the Moon. As The Who hit the road, perhaps for the last time, after another drummer-oriented crisis, they reboot Who Are You? Keith Moon's arduous yet fascinating swan song, with punks at the gate, scraps in the studio, and Townsend's demons flaring, it was already hard going. Then came their drummer's tragic implosion. We were all traumatized, discovers Tom Doyle. The Who were only two songs into their set at the Boston Garden when Keith Moon collapsed. The date was March 9, 1976, the opening show of the U.S. leg of the band's tour in support of The Who by Numbers, released 5 months before. Ominously, the former unpredictable drummer had sounded shaky from the start, muddling through I Can't Explain, before his playing turned sloppy during Substitute, then descended into trilogite thumping, as the rest of the band noisily attempted to cover up the mess. In the last chorus, Moon stopped playing altogether, before briefly rousing himself back into consciousness and then passing out. We've got a little bit of a problem, Pete Townsend calmly informed the crowd. Keith Moon is in very, very bad shape. He's got the flu, he's out of it, Roger Daltrey added, only half truthfully. Protesting voices began to rise from the audience. Nobody wants to play more than The Who. I'll tell you that now, the singer forcefully stressed in the face of the growing uproar. But we don't want to kill Keith Moon, right? The official explanation was that he had flu, Daltrey later elucidated in his 2018 memoir, Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite. The real reason was the usual one, brandy and barbiturates. Unlike 3 years before, at the Cow Palace in Daly City, California, on November the 20th, 1973, when Moon had similarly keeled over behind his kit after scarfing tranquilizers, there was no Who fan hero to save the day. That night, Townsend had hopefully asked, "Can anyone play the drums?" Up stepped local amateur sticksman Scott Halpin to help push the band through three more numbers. The Who's 1975-76 tour of Europe and America, their longest and most ambitious yet, boasting an expensive and elaborate laser display, was turning out to be a grind. It involved the group performing a strictly crowd-pleasing set that John Entwistle jadedly referred to as the same old stage act, a variety of their 60s hits and a suite of songs from Tommy, with only a few selections from Who's Next, and the latest LP they were supposed to be promoting. While Moon quickly recovered, and the jaunt continued 2 nights later at Madison Square Garden, the drummer's plan remained unreliable. By the summer, at the close of a four-date third leg culminating on August the 9th at Miami Stadium, as Townsend noted in his 2012 autobiography, Who I Am, Keith's tempos were sliding, and some of his most ambitious drum fills were falling short. Post-gig, Moon collapsed again at his hotel and was hospitalized for 8 days. He returned, the guitarist grimly noted, drinking a bottle of Remy Martin a day on top of his medication. Townsend was never able to understand the root causes of his bandmates' entourage behavior and apparent death wish. He was a fucking pain in the ass, Keith was. Just a pain in the ass, he told this writer with a grin in 2019. You look at his childhood and there's no tragedy. There's no difficulty. I can't work out what the fuck he was doing. All the more remarkable, then, that in the dying moments of the final show of the tour at Toronto's Maple Leaf Gardens on October 21st, 1976, The Who dramatically sparked into life, jamming on a simple three-chord riff with a Kominsky groove. Moon pummeled the kit with Klaus Dinger-like minimalist intensity, driving the band along a precise straight line before his plan characteristically morphed into rolling thunder. No one was to know that it was to be his last appearance with The Who on a North American stage. Throughout this purgative wig-out, Townsend improvised a simple chant involving the phrase, "Who are you? Who are you?" It was an existential question that was to haunt Townsend, Moon, and The Who as a whole during the horribly eventful period that was to immediately follow. The circumstances leading up to the recording of Who Are You, fatefully the group's last album with their pyrotechnic, if problematic drummer, found a tired and disillusioned band flying in the face of punky musical fashions. As evidenced by a new and vastly expanded 89-track box set reissue of the album, featuring demos, rehearsals, live performances, rejected Glyn Johns mixes, and new Steven Wilson Atmos remixes. It saw Townsend double down on the synth experiments. He had first dabbled in circa 1971's Who's Next, and lean into FM rock, while lyrically blaring his creative torment in Guitar and Pen, and his music biz disenchantment in the cynical new song. Here's a little bit of the song, Who Are You? From the Who album, Who Are You? If Townsend was troubled, then Moon seemed lost. When the 75-76 tour was over, he stayed behind in Los Angeles, mainly to escape Britain's 83% tax for high earners. "They're driving out all those people who make the money," Moon moaned to NME, while fretting about the instability of music careers. "What so many people fail to appreciate," he stressed, "is that in many cases a person may only ever have a single opportunity to make it." During this period, a frequent visitor to Moon's Malibu Beach house was his younger godson, Zach Starkey, son of Ringo Starr. My dad used to send me to stay with Keith in Malibu quite regularly for the weekend, Starkey told Mojo last year. In retrospect, laughs, not the greatest babysitter ever, right? We sat and drank beer together, even though I was 10 or 11. He got me into the Beach Boys, and he talked about surfing and girls. It turns out he'd only ever been surfing once, and he nearly drowned, and he never did it again. All the while, not playing drums and largely idle, Moon's extreme ebbing only worsened during his time in California, particularly in an era where the L.A. music scene was characterized by wild overindulgence. It was setting into a nothing-to-do lifestyle that messed him up, reckoned Entwistle. He had a pill for every time of the day. In one moment of desperation, the drummer's girlfriend, Swedish model Annette Walter Lax, sought the help of the couple's neighbor in Malibu, actor Larry Hagman, who had shared the screen with Moon, typecast as feral drummer J.D. Clover in 1974 Rise and Fall rock film Stardust, reprising his role from 1973's That'll Be the Day. Moon duly checked into a Cedars-Sinai treatment facility for 3 days in February 1977 in another failed attempt to clean up. An ongoing film career was clearly in the drummer's plans, leading to perhaps the strangest movie cameo of his brief and checkered screen career, which had included playing a harpist, a nun, and Frank Zappa's 1971 mind-boggler 200 Motels. Appearing alongside octogenarian film star Mae West, and a supporting cast that included Tony Curtis, Ringo Starr, and Alice Cooper, Moon hammed it up magnificently as a camp fashion designer. A different movie crew arrived at the Malibu Beach House in August 1977 to film interterrestrial scenes for director Jeff Stein's Mosaic Who documentary, The Kids Are All Right. Interviewed in tandem with his booze buddy Ringo, slurring throughout, a bearded Moon was totally wired and sharply funny. Canvassing his opinions on the other Who members, Starr cheekily inquired of his relationship with Daltrey. What about the little singer? What's your opinion of him? Well, I think he does a damn good job out there, Moon averred, before praising the frontman's mic-whirling talents. He manages to revolve it so fast that when people throw things, he gets a sort of desiccated egg and a sliced tomato. At the end of the night, I have a salad mixed. I just sprinkle some salt and Italian seasoning on it. Back in England, the other members of The Who were not seeing the funny side and grew increasingly concerned about their self-exiled drummer. Townsend flew to L.A. in autumn 1977 and convinced Moon to return to the U.K. and rejoin the band for their next venture. Keith didn't need much persuasion. I was really drifting away with no direction, he subsequently confessed. I'd try to do things and get involved with projects, but nothing ever came close to the feeling I get when I'm working with the guys. Having briefly reconvened in July 1977 at Shepperton Studios in Surrey, where The Who had leased two enormous sound stages and an office building to use as the nerve center of their music and film operations, the future of the band looked altogether positive. Performing for the benefit of Jeff Stein's cameras, they powered through some of their standards and indulged in semi-piss-taking renditions of the Beatles, I saw her standing there, and the Beach Boys' Barbara Ann. A sweaty moon attempted falsetto, lead on the ladder from behind his kit. And yet, 2 months later, recording what would become Who Are You, the drummer was in worryingly bad shape. Ahead of preliminary sessions beginning in September 1977 at the band's Ramport Studios in Battersea, the drummer had been suffering from seizures due to sudden alcohol withdrawal. Nonetheless, on day one, he appeared to be back to his old devilish self, likely since he'd reacquainted himself with the brandy bottle and other familiar substances. Firstly, he took a strange dislike to a new message board that had been bought for the studio and set it alight. Next, he tested out the drum sound that John Ashley, engineering for producer Glyn Johns, had spent the previous day perfecting. Once Ashley declared himself satisfied with the studio balance, as later he recalled, Moon stood up and walked through the bloody kit, wrecking the set up. Such unhinged antics were easier to tolerate when Moon was on top musically form. But when the tapes rolled, it quickly became apparent that the drummer's timing was all over the place. Part of the problem was that Moon was being pushed by the others to lay down straighter beats, at the time in vogue on U.S. rock radio, that inhibited his inherently frantic style. Given other current musical fashions, it might have been a better idea to allow Moon completely off the leash. The drummer, like the rest of The Who, had a complicated attitude toward punk, which he and his bandmates had clearly inspired. Paul McCartney later told Mojo's Paul DeNoyer, "I know people like Keith Moon were not so much threatened as just pissed off that the people who were emulating his drum style were calling him a boring old fart." Roger Daltrey was characteristically belligerent about the new upstarts, deciding, "Fuck you, you can't outpunk The Who." Pete Townsend reacted by drinking harder. One night, meeting Steve Jones and Paul Cook of the Sex Pistols at the Speakeasy Club in London's West End, ranting at the pair about the financial unfairness of the music business, and then conking out in a Soho doorway before being woken by a policeman, thus finding inspiration for the verse of the work in progress, "Who Are You?" Moon, meanwhile, taunted the punks, turning up at the Vortex on Waldorf Street in his Rolls Royce and conspicuously playing the big spender at the bar. "They threatened Keith," remembers Townsend, of the drummer's fellow gate-goers, club-goers. "And he laughed at them, inviting them to come out and ride around in his car. I wasn't so brave." Although, in truth, a bet in private, The Who could be just as Larry as the punks. In October 1977, tempers erupted in the studio when Glyn Johns played Daltrey synthesized string parts that had been added to two tracks, Sister Disco and Had Enough. The singer bluntly told the producer he thought the results were crap. An argument broke out, and the two spilled into a corridor. Johns apparently called Daltrey a little cunt. The singer responded by headbutting him. Johns stormed out of the studio and refused to work with The Who's frontman for the remainder of the record, with John Ashley assuming a co-producer role. The turbulence continued into December. On the night of the 15th, at the Gaumont State Cinema in Kilburn, North London, during a show staged for Jeff Stein's cameras. A Flabby Moon underperformed, and Townsend lashed out at his perceived punk enemies in the crowd. Well, this wasn't fucking worth filming, Stein, the guitarist huffily declared into his microphone. Might as well send the cameramen home. Townsend's anger didn't abate over the Christmas period and at home with his parents in Ealing. An argument provoked him to punch his hand through a window, causing lacerations that were to delay the album's progress by 2 months. Then, just as the sessions were set to recommence, the band's new keyboard player, John Rabbit Bundrick, broke his arm after falling out of a cab following a drinking session with Moon, requiring the emergency drafting of Ernest Weil zombie Rod Argent. In March 1978, at RAK Studios in St. John's Wood, Moon struggled to get grips with the 6/8 time signature of Townsend's Music Must Change. The difficulty from Entwistle's perspective was that the drummer couldn't think of anything to play. Daltrey later said of the song, Keith couldn't play to it. Keith could play great Moon drums, and that was it. And here's some of that song, Music Must Change, by The Who.
Deep in the back of my mind is an unrealized sound. Every feeling I get from the street says it soon could be found. When I hear the cold lies of the pusher, I know it exists. It's confirmed in the eyes of the kids, emphasized with their fists. But the high has to rise from the low. Volcanoes explode through the snow. The mosquito sting brings a dream, but the poison's deranged. The music must change, for we're chewing a bone. We soared like the spiral hawk fly, then we drop like a stone. Like the tide and the waves, growing slowly in rain.
For Townsend, the problem was more acute. He did actually physically stop playing, the guitarist told me in 2019. We were recording the song, and he couldn't play, and we ended up using footsteps as the rhythm. Townsend held an emergency summit at a nearby restaurant, reportedly threatening to sack Moon if he didn't sort himself out. Moon insisted, "I can do triplet jazz," then comically announced, "I am the best Keith Moon-type drummer in the world." Still, Moon heeded Townsend's warning, and most of the drummer's parts for Who Are You were far more capably overdubbed in April 78 back at Ramport in the final 2 weeks of recording. Somehow, he managed to find a middle ground, particularly on the stomping synth-led Had Enough and Sister Disco. Between straight-ahead, four-on-the-floor rock beats and his Baroque drum fills, his old fire had suddenly returned. "It was just fucking phenomenal," enthused John Entwistle of the explosive drum solo that Keith Moon played for the benefit of only the other members of The Who and their crew at the end of a particularly productive day of filming and recording at Ramport on May the 4th, 1978. The plan had been for Jeff Stein to film the band miming to the title track and first single from Who Are You. Spontaneously, the group began jamming on top of the master tape in spur-of-the-moment performances, quickly captured by John Ashley and subsequently cut into the video. In the footage, Moon typically looned around, his headphones gaffer taped to his head, but also played brilliantly. 3 weeks later, on May 25th, The Who returned to the stage at Shepperton, performing for an invited audience that would be the classic lineup's last show together. Jeff Stein was lacking decent film takes of Baba O'Reilly and Won't Get Fooled Again, and the gig was set up expressly for this purpose. But in the end, as revealed in the new box set's previously unreleased Who Are You outtakes, the band played for far longer, hitting peaks and sliding into troughs. Moon pummeled through opener Baba O'Reilly, then began flailing more wildly, erratically pushing and pulling the tempo of Entwistle's My Wife, losing the plot several times as the band threatened to fall apart. Periodically, he broke out into, as if to prove a point, nifty triplet jazz rolls before a messy Who Are You prompted Daltrey to apologize to the crowd, promising that the upcoming recorded version of the song sounded absolutely nothing like that at all. Later, Moon experienced a surge of energy, the result reportedly of a hefty double shovel of cocaine, and turned in a charged performance of Won't Get Fooled Again that was both solid and flashy. Here's a little bit of that song, Won't Get Fooled Again, by The Who. At its close, Moon, for one more time, climbed over his drum kit and was immediately hugged by Townsend. Speaking to the Evening Standard 3 months later, the drummer was doubtful about The Who's ongoing prospects as a touring band. As regards records and films, I can see a future for The Who, he said, not on the road, not in the same way as the Stones. I certainly see The Who broadening their horizons. He went on to talk up a new holograph film technology that was apparently in development by the band's team. I'm much more involved, much more interested in some of the things that we're doing at Shepperton, he emphasized. In August, the same month that Who Are You was released, peaking at UK number 6 and US number 2, a private screening of a rough cut of The Kids Are All Right was held for the band and their associates. Spanning the period between their performance of I Can't Explain for the US Shindig TV show in 1965 and the May 78 gig at Shepperton, it documented just how much Moon had changed in just 13 years. It must have been horrific for Keith, Daltrey later emphasized, this young drummer, great-looking kid, going bananas, who turns out at the end of the film a fat old thing. Falling off the drums, being held up, he had gone to seed, and he wanted to get it back. The last public appearance of Keith Moon was on Wednesday, September the 6th, 1978, at a Paul McCartney-organized screening of the Buddy Holly story at the Leicester Square Odeon, preceded by a bash at the Peppermint Park restaurant in Covent Garden, showing support for his other ex-Beatle pal, the Who's drummer turned up wearing a Wings t-shirt. Kenny Jones, the ex-Faces drummer, who was, under terrible circumstances, soon to replace Moon in the ranks of the Who, ended up hanging out with his fellow stickman that evening. I found myself at a table with Keith and his girlfriend, Paul and Linda, and David Frost, Jones recalled to Mojo in 2024. Keith and I were talking. I said, "How you been?" He said, "Yeah, great. I'm not taking any drugs, and I've stopped drinking completely." It was more the drinking with Mooney than anything. He said, "I'm taking these pills, and they keep me off drink. If I take one, I get violently ill." The rest is all grim detail. Moon and Walter Lax left the screening midway, returning to the top floor flat in Corazon Place, Mayfair, that the couple were renting from singer Harry Nilsson. Nilsson had been reluctant to lease the apartment to Moon, believing it to be cursed, following the death there of Cass Elliot of the Mamas and the Papas in the summer of 1974. Townsend had reassured Nilsson, saying lightning wouldn't strike in the same place twice. Back at home, Moon took more of the heminervirin sedatives prescribed to alleviate his alcohol withdrawal symptoms. His doctor, restricting him to 3 tablets a day, had naively given the drummer a bottle filled with 100. He fell asleep in front of the TV while watching the Vincent Price starring 1971 horror flick, The Abdominal Dr. Phoebus. In the morning, he woke and ate a breakfast of steak and eggs made for him by Walter Lax, popped more pills, and then nodded out. On the afternoon of September the 7th, his girlfriend woke to find him dead. A post-mortem found 32 pills in his system. "I turned the TV on," Kenny Jones remembered, "and the news came on. You know, Keith Moon was found dead in his flat. I said, 'What the fuck? I just left him. He's up to mischief again.' I never believed it. Then I found out it was real." In a state of shock, their minds fogged by grief, Daltrey and Townsend could never quite remember who called who with the awful news. The singer claimed it was the guitarist, who swore it was the other way around. After holding a 3/4 band meeting with manager Bill Kerbsley, the Who resolved to continue. "I said to Pete, 'We don't have to stop.' Daltrey remembered, 'You can't replace Keith, but you can keep the music going. It's all about the music in the end.'" Townsend subsequently released a media statement. "No one could ever take Keith's place," he stressed, "but we're more determined than ever to carry on." Moon's funeral was a private ceremony with the details kept secret from the press. On September 13th, at the Golders Green Crematorium in North London. When it came to the many floral tributes, Daltrey had one commissioned in the shape of a lobbed champagne bottle poking out of a TV screen. Kenny Jones was there, but sneaked in and out unnoticed. I didn't want to see anyone, he explained, so I crept up, I did a little poem, little bunch of flowers, and I just left it and nipped out, so no one knew I was there. In a darkly resonant joke, one that he surely would have appreciated, Keith Moon had been photographed with a group on the cover of Who Are You, amid cable clutter and in front of their gargantuan PA system, straddling a chair with the words, "Not to be taken away," stenciled on its back. As Townsend had acknowledged in his missive, the moon-shaped hole in the Who was to prove impossible to fill. Pete turned to drink, Daltrey told Mojo in 2018. Pete never did drugs all the way through till Keith died. I think that was from heartbreak. We all were traumatized by that. That was hard to get over. Keith was only 32. It's young, isn't it? The worst thing was we were expecting it any time with him, 'cause he had 9 lives, and he lived 9 lives as well. The shock became even greater for some reason. In November 1978, Kenny Jones, who had previously played on 7 tracks on 1975's Tommy Film soundtrack, while Moon was filming Stardust, was revealed as the new drummer in The Who. When I said I would join, Jones recalled, I said, I'm not going to copy Keith Moon. I can only play me. That's all I can do. I'm a completely different drummer. I'm straighter, but I like certain things Keith did, so I want to do them. I'm going to compliment them if I can, but I'll have to do it my way. This new version of The Who debuted at the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park, North London, on May the 2nd, 1979. Their return coincided with a mod revival, at least part ignited by The Jam, as evidenced by the packs of youths arriving at the venue on scooters and wearing parkas. It was a resurgence, further fueled in the summer of 1979 by the cinematic release of the film version of Quadrophenia. But for Roger Daltrey in particular, something was irrevocably lost from The Who with the death of Moon. Without Keith, we weren't the band we were, he said. But then I was in a strange place myself, so it was hard. In many ways, the singer has remained the keeper of the drummer's flame, pushing for decades to have a Moon biopic, provisionally titled The Real Me, and still in development, brought to the screen. The thunder of Moon's drums, Daltrey told me, still awed by his long-gone pal's unique playing, that will reverberate forever. Moon himself, too, it seems, always kept one eye on his legend. Writer, publicist Keith Altham later remembered visiting the drummer on an unspecified date in a London hospital after a suspected stroke. Altham voiced aloud his hope that Moon would take this particular health scare as a warning to slow down. You know me, dear boy, the drummer announced. Mortality, I never consider. Now, immortality, I take quite seriously. Now I move on to the article that's titled Filter Reissues, and this is titled Reign Supreme. The punk rock landmark that keeps on giving celebrates half a century with an expanded anniversary edition produced by bassist Tony Shanahan. Patti Smith, Horses, 50th Anniversary Edition. On February the 3rd, 1975, ex-Animals singer Eric Burdon headlined 2 shows at the Main Point, a 250-seater coffee house in Bryn Mawr, a Philadelphia suburb. The opening act was singer-poet Patti Smith, making her first hometown appearance. She partly grew up in the city after a year of New York nights with guitarist Lenny Kaye. and pianist Richard Soul, and a 45 of Primal Blues and Inclination, Hey Joe / Piss Factory, released at the end of 74. Smith was also showing off a combo with more groove and boom. Bassist Ivan Kral joined 4 days earlier. I was there as the main points PR guy and keen to see what I had wrought after urging my boss to book Smith for the gig. I wish I'd taken set list notes, but I vividly recall Smith, a rock and roll futurist with a classicist soul, standing at the back of the club while Burden was on stage, spellbound by his blues and vocal fury. 3 days later, on February the 6th, Smith was headed for her own Transcendence, her debut LP Horses, recording demos at RCA's 6th Avenue Studios with Kay, Soul, and Kral. An event so newsworthy in the early ferment of New York punk that John Rockwell of the New York Times mentioned it in his column the next day. RCA barely got a chance to pass on Smith. Rockwell soon reported that Arista's Clive Davis had swooped in and signed her. There was another demo session with the quartet. Then, in June, a drummer, J.D. Daugherty, over 5 sometimes contentious weeks with producer John Cale that fall, the quintet made Horses, 8 tracks of electric medicine dance. Brill Building Yearning and Frenzied Improvised Levitation at Jimi Hendrix's 8th Street Sanctuary, Electric Lady, where Smith cut Hey Joe. On the final day of mixing, as dawn broke over Lower Manhattan, Kay wrote in his memoir, "Lightning Striking." We walked up the stairs, out of the studio, into the future. Released on November 10, 1975, Horses is the punk rock landmark that keeps on giving. A raging, renewing magic and dreaming made with rock's fundamental bones by an insurgent bard who found her voice and mission at the crossroads of Leader of the Pack, like a Rolling Stone and Howl. Smith's infamous refusal of Easy Salvation at the front of Van Morrison's Gloria, the 9-minute passage through grief to escape in the wah-wah morning and doo-wop scattering of Birdland, the combined evocation of Smith's pole star, the French poet Arthur Rimbaud and Wilson Pickett in Land, the band reading her vocal moods and soaring with empathetic stampede. This was an album forged in the fugue of war at CBGB and Max's Kansas City, built for eternal life and transfiguration. And here's a little bit of the song Gloria by Patti Smith from her album Horses.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord of my sleeve, thick heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me, me. People say beware, but I don't care. The words are just rules and regulations to me, me. Party. I just get bored.
I aspired to that, Smith told me, in 1996, in a grateful way, citing the truth and communion she found as a young woman in Highway 61 Revisited and Electric Ladyland. When we did Horses, I was really conscious of that responsibility. Note the we. It was her name on the front, her iconic confrontation in Robert Mapplethorpe's cover portrait. But Horses was the work of a band, still being born as they wrote and recorded together. And it was a long road to satisfaction, as revealed in the quartet demos. Horses' outtakes and songs left for later in this 50th anniversary reissue, produced by Smith's longtime bassist, Tony Shannon. Three tracks from that day at RCA are very close to the eerie skeletal momentum. I remember from The Main Point, with a surprising emphasis on ballads at this session. The Miracles' 1966 hit, The Hunter Gets Captured by the Game, then a club date fixture, and We Three, a plea to save a doomed relationship, revisited on 1978's Easter. Gloria, at this point, is the near sum of familiar parts, probably like hearing the Rolling Stones before they got Charlie Watts. Smith's sliding half-chanted notes in the opening line from a 1970 poem, Oath, are akin to her blues hymn delivery in Hey Joe. Soul leading the rave up like Little Richard, firing McCoy Tyner chords. But her vocal asides, make her mine, don't quite score without Doherty's affirmative kick. And this version ends without the false stop and blitzing reprise on Horses. It's literally take one, a vibrant, committed performance, and just short of Breakaway. And here's a little bit of the song, The Hunter Gets Captured by the Game, from Patti Smith. These differences, omissions, and songs set aside do not change or challenge the history Smith made with Horses. She knew what she had when it was done. An artist wears his work in places of wounds, Smith once wrote of her early poems. Here, then, is a glimpse of the sores of my generation, often crude, irreverent, but done, I can assure with a fierce heart. Horses was that promise on a record. Now there is more of it. Now I move on to the classic album review, and this week it's Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, 2015. Kendrick Lamar writes his music through colors. Lamar works synthesthetically, says audio engineer Derek Ali, in the Compton-based rapper's Rolling Stone feature out this month. According to Ali, Lamar demanded certain colors to be created within the songs on To Pimp a Butterfly. These particular hues, whether purple or even light green, dictated the moods deemed necessary for the themes at hand. This begins to explain why this album is so musically diverse. It flies from 70s-styled funk to neo-soul influences, all in accordance with Lamar's personal visions. And for anyone who's truly immersed themselves in To Pimp a Butterfly, for the past week, this artistic feat seems more and more like cause to celebrate. The backdrop always suites the accompanying lyrical themes exceptionally well. The blueprint of The Sinister You is as laced with rife tension as its counterpoint, I, is abundant with jaunty self-confirmation. Because of the wide array of contributors to ensure the album meets the emotional quotas Kendrick has set forth for it, every song possesses a distinctive identity, a different color fleshed out by its instrumentation. And the lyrical wonders Lamar works on top of all this is even more worthy of praise. And here's some of that song, You, by Kendrick Lamar, off the album To Pimp a Butterfly.
Watching anonymous strangers telling me that I'm yours. But you ain't no confessional tolerance, nothing special. What can I blame you for? God can name several. Situation I start with your little sister baking. A baby aside, just a teenager. Where your patience? What was your antennas? What was the influence you speak of? You preached in front of 100,000 but never reached.
Kendrick Lamar writes his music about color. There's no bigger topic on To Pimp a Butterfly than race relations. It's something the 27-year-old rapper has focused on throughout his musical career. Race is emphasized because it is relevant. The surrounding inequities, inequalities, after all, single-handedly spawned rap in the first place. These songs are not just about skin color, but about its implications, how, for instance, Lamar is treated by the music industry for being part of a culture that is hastily and thoughtlessly thrown in with one status symbol after another. You can live at the mall, offers Lamar's portrayal of Uncle Sam toward his successful rapper self in Wesley's Theory, but this is not the future he wants. Now that Kendrick has found success, his main desire is to help raise up those who have helped him along the way. He is aiming to make the voices of the oppressed louder. Lamar sees this as his obligation, his duty, now that he's garnered the audience he has sought this whole time. This can be difficult for a newfound man of means, especially when his connections from childhood could very well resent him for his success. And To Pimp a Butterfly is about this conflict, as well as the overwhelmingly ill-founded sentiment that any particular person, regardless of skin color, deserves anything less than what they want in this world. As Rhapsody, featured rapper in Complexion, a Zulu Love, puts it, we all on the same team, blues and Paris. No colors ain't a thing. Here's some of that song, Complexion, A Zulu Love, by Kendrick Lamar.
Reflection don't mean a thing.
It's a Zulu love.
Ooh, complexion.
Two steps.
It all feels the same.
It's a Zulu love.
Dark is the midnight hour, her bright is the morning sun. Give a fuck about your complexion, I know what the German's done. Sneaking through the back window, I'm a good feel. I made a flower for you out of cotton just to chill with you. You know I go the distance, you know I'm 10 toes down. Even if Mass are listening, cover your ears, he about to mention complexion.
Kendrick Lamar wrote this album in order to point out differences between colors. They don't just exist. They have a right to be appreciated and celebrated. Just because you wore a different gang color than mine's doesn't mean I can't respect you as a black man, Lamar reveals in Mortal Man, the song containing the final rendition of To Pimp a Butterfly's reoccurring poem. Differences needn't be a cause of conflict, especially when American minorities are given enough undue grief. There is no treatise for equal treatment, for such a concept would undermine entirely the characteristics unique to every hue. Each color has its own history, and throughout To Pimp a Butterfly, Lamar emphasizes that blackness holds a narrative of its own, extensive and long misunderstood. Lamar sees it as a perseverance through countless adversaries, a certain kind of pride experienced by those who have waded through the murk spewed from white capitalist America. Perhaps blackness is more than a color. Maybe its surrounding framework suggests it is instead an ideology of togetherness, and as Kendrick would have it, respect from one to another, love for those who love you back. And once again, unfortunately, we're all out of time. Please join me next week when I read a long article about Bob Dylan's start from 1956 to 1963 and a classic album review of Boys and Girls by Alabama Shakes. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
It all feels the same.
It's a
Dark is the midnight hour.